Good evening, everyone. Tonight we are in Exodus 12. And Exodus 12 is one of those chapters that you should know what's in it. It contains, the Exodus. It contains the beginning of the Passover. And it contains the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So other places in Scripture talk about Passover and Unleavened Bread, but this is the beginning. This is the first mention. So verse 1, the Lord said to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, this month shall be the beginning of months for you. So the first 20 verses in this chapter are going to be talking about the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And the month of the Exodus was going to be the first month on the Jewish or the Hebrew religious calendar. Okay, so there's several things you need to understand about the Hebrew calendar system. Unlike our calendar, theirs is a lunar calendar. Ours is a solar calendar. So their calendar, each month goes from new moon to new moon. And our calendar, new moon is somewhere within the month because our calendar is based on the sun. Their calendar is based on the moon. This first month that he's talking about here is part of their religious calendar. They also have a civil calendar, which is different from the religious calendar. So, and I'll explain that in a second. So before the Babylonian captivity, the first month was called Abib. And you see that in all of the references in the Pentateuch. After the Babylonian captivity, the first month was named Nisan. And so you're going to see that in books dealing with post-captivity, Esther, Ezra, Nehemiah. So it's the same month, it's just got a different name. Now, if that's not bad enough, today's Hebrew religious calendar, the first month is Nisan. In the civil calendar, Nisan is the seventh month. So if somebody talks about Nisan, you have to ask him, are you talking religious calendar or civil calendar? Because they're not the same. So just some things to put in the file cabinet in your mind. So this month is the beginning of months. This is going to be the first month of the year. Now, the instructions he's going to give down to verse 20 have to do with all succeeding Passovers, all of the Passovers after this one, because this Passover that they're going to celebrate this day is going to be a very rushed Passover. Everything is going to happen within a matter of hours. All succeeding Passovers are going to start on the 10th day of the month, then the 14th day of the month, then there's a 15th day of the month to the 21st day of the month. So there's going to be several weeks going on here for all succeeding Passovers, but what's going to happen at this point, everything's going to happen in a matter of hours. So Moses is getting these instructions from the Lord. He's writing them down, and he's going to relate them to the people of Israel so that the next Passover that they're going to celebrate in the wilderness, they know what to do. So these instructions are for the next Passover and every Passover after that, okay? So he says, on the 10th of this month, They are each one to take a lamb for themselves. Now, the 10th of the month isn't the date of the Passover. Like I said, this is what's for Passovers after this. So each one is going to take a lamb for themselves according to their father's household, a lamb for each household. And if the household's too small for a lamb, because the Lord doesn't want to waste things. So if there's just a man and his wife in the house and there's no one else there, they're not going to eat an entire lamb in one evening. So if the household is too small, then you can go to your neighbor nearest you and have a lamb between the two households, one according to the number of persons, what each man should eat, divide the lamb. So if my house is too small to have a whole lamb, then I join up with my neighbor, and together we have our Passover lamb together. And then he gives some instructions, some qualifications for the Passover lamb. First of all, it has to be unblemished. There can't be any defect whatsoever. And that's true of all of the sacrifices that are presented to the Lord. No defects whatsoever. In fact, in Malachi, he even chews out the priests because they were offering blemished animals to the Lord. And I think one of the reasons that right from the beginning, unblemished, is because this is a picture. And this is a picture of what the Messiah was going to be. Hebrews 9 says, Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God. And 1 Peter 1, the precious blood as of a lamb, unblemished and spotless, the blood of Christ. So the unblemished quality of this sacrifice pointed to the ultimate sacrifice of Christ. The lamb had to be a male. And that's going to be true of most sacrifices, not all. There were some sacrifices that allowed for a female animal. For example, the peace offering. It could be either a male or a female. The offering for the sin of a common person and for specific sins was to be a female. When a leper was cleansed, they were to offer a male and a female. But this one, it's a male, and it's 1 year old. So keep track of the age of your lambs. And again, this is true of many sacrifices, not all of them. Some of the sacrifices, the age was not relevant. It's just not given. And it could be a sheep or a goat. Could be either one. And some offerings required, some of the offerings you could bring either as well, sheep or a goat. So you take your lamb, you set it apart from the 10th day, you examine it, you keep an eye on this thing until the 14th day. And then he says, verse 6, the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel. So at twilight, everyone in the nation of Israel was to kill their lamb. So the lamb they selected on the 10th day, they kept until the 14th day. At twilight, every household in the nation sacrifices their lamb. And then he says, once you've done that, you're going to collect the blood. And you're going to take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts and on the lintel of the houses in which they eat it. So they collect the blood. They put the blood on the two doorposts on the house and on what we call the header, above the door. And the house in which the lamb was slain was also the house in which it was eaten. You don't sprinkle the blood on your house and then go someplace else to eat it. You stay in that house. In verses 8, 9, and 10, he gives some instructions for how the Passover lamb was to be eaten. And some of these are just unappealing. So the lamb was to be eaten on the same evening it was killed. So you eat the flesh the same night. Anything that's left over until morning, you're not to eat it. It's to be burned with fire. That's not true of some offerings. There were some offerings, most offerings, it was consumed the day it was killed. The free will offerings and the peace offerings could also be eaten the next day. So there's some distinctions here. The lamb is to be roasted with fire. It's not to be eaten raw. Why anybody would even do that is beyond me. It wasn't to be boiled. Some people like boiled meat. This is to be roasted with fire. The entire lamb is roasted with fire. Its head, its legs, and its entrails. In other words, once you slit the lamb's throat and drain out its blood, you take the entire thing and put it on the fire. You don't skin it, you don't gut it, you put the entire thing on the fire and you roast it. And the hair is going to be burned off and it's going to smell awful, I can just imagine. And then once it's all roasted with fire, then you open it up and don't go too deep, and you eat what meat you can get off of this thing without getting into the body cavity. And what's left over, then you burn that with fire. The lamb was to be eaten with unleavened bread and bitter herbs. And the reason it was to be eaten with unleavened bread is to commemorate the fact that the people of Israel are going to leave Egypt before their bread dough was leavened. If you look over at Deuteronomy 16, he says in verse 3, you shall not eat leavened bread with it. 7 days you shall eat it with unleavened bread. And then he describes it, the bread of affliction. For you came out of the land of Egypt in haste. In other words, you came out so quickly that your bread dough didn't even have time to rise. So this unleavened bread commemorated that fact. They're to eat it with bitter herbs, and that was to commemorate the bitter affliction that was imposed on the people of Israel by the Egyptians. So back in chapter 1, it says that the Egyptians made their lives bitter with hard labor. And so the bitter herbs was to commemorate that fact. You shall eat it in this manner. So here's some more instructions. With your loins girded, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand. Now, typically, when you went into a home in the Middle East, and this is still true of, you know, Canada, many places in Europe, Asia, you take your shoes off before you go into the house. But the Passover meal was to be eaten with your feet shod. And with your staff in your hand. So your feet are shod, your staff is in your hand. It gives the impression that you're eating this meal standing up. They didn't have tables back then. You would sit on the floor. And even today, many places in the Middle East, you sit on the floor. But it's hard to sit on the floor with your staff in your hand. So it gives the impression that you're eating this meal standing up, and he says, you're eating it in haste. You're not lingering over this. You're eating this quickly. You're not there to enjoy the fellowship and chat around the table. You're just gobbling this thing down because you're about to leave. And they were to do this in all succeeding Passovers to commemorate that fact. And then he says, it is the Lord's Passover. This is the first reference to what this meal and this event was called. It's the Lord's Passover. He hasn't called it that yet. This is the first time. And then he tells us in verse 13 that this is where the name comes from. When I see the blood, I will pass over you. So the Passover was God literally passing over the house that had blood on the doorway. So verse 12, I will go through the land of Egypt on that night. So the Lord himself, as the angel of the Lord, is going to go through the midst of the land of Egypt, and he's going to execute his judgments on the Egyptians. I'm going to go through. Back in chapter 11, he said it. At midnight, I am going out into the midst of Egypt. Verse 23, the Lord will pass through to smite the Egyptians. So he's going out. And he says, I'm going to strike down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt. Everyone, every firstborn who is not behind a doorway covered in blood is going to die. And he's already warned Pharaoh that back in chapter 11. At midnight, I'm going through the midst of Egypt. All the firstborn in the land of Egypt will die. The firstborn of Pharaoh who sits on his throne. He's already warned him. Pharaoh didn't heed the warning. Chapter 13, he talks about this. The Lord killed every firstborn in the land of Egypt. Later on, he talks about the Lord struck all the firstborn in the land of Egypt. So he's not sending some plague, hail, or locusts, or whatever. He himself is going into the land of Egypt, and he is going to strike down the firstborn. And it's not just the firstborn of people. It's the firstborn of the beasts, the cattle, as well. So, and he's already warned them of that. And against all the gods of Egypt, I will execute judgment. So in addition to executing his judgments on the Egyptians, he's going to continue to execute his judgments against the gods of the Egyptians. And he's going to show that your gods are powerless to do anything against what I'm doing. Psalm 135. Verse 5, I know that the Lord is great and that our Lord is above all gods. Verse 8, he smote the firstborn of Egypt, both man and beast. He's already told them. Isaiah talks about it. The idols of Egypt will tremble at his presence. Jeremiah says, I will set fire to the temple of the gods of Egypt. So, even though he executed judgments at the Exodus, the Egyptians went back and kept on worshiping gods that couldn't save them. And so he tells Isaiah, I'm going to destroy your idols again. And then he tells Jeremiah, I'm going to set fire to the temples of your gods, and I'm going to destroy them again. Why do you keep worshiping gods that can't save you? So, and then he says, I am the Lord. He's making it clear who is doing this. This isn't just happening by chance. I am the one doing this. I am the promise-making, covenant-keeping God. I told you I would do this. I told you I would bring Israel out, and I'm going to do it. I'm the Lord. The blood shall be a sign for you on your houses where you live. So the blood on the doorway would be a sign for the people in the house that they're protected from the plague befalling the Egyptians. If you're in a house with blood on the doorway, you're protected. But the blood on the doorway was also a sign for the Lord. When I see the blood, I will pass over you. So when he goes through the land of Egypt, any house that doesn't have blood on the doorway gets struck. Any house with blood on the doorway, he passes over. This is another one of those times when the Lord makes a distinction between the people of Israel and the people of Egypt. But this particular time, unlike the previous times, the people of Israel had to do something to participate in that distinction. All the other times, they just had to sit there and watch it happen, and they were protected. This time, they actually had to do something to distinguish themselves from the people of Egypt. They had to take their lamb, sacrifice it, put its blood on the doorpost and on the lintel. They participated in that distinction. And I always think of Rahab, the harlot in Jericho. She did the same thing. The spies told her, you hang this scarlet thread out your window, and when we see the scarlet thread, we'll pass over your house. If we don't see it, everyone in your house is dead, and their blood is on your head. So you put this scarlet thread out your window, and when we see the scarlet thread, you'll be safe. So the Lord says in verse 14, this day will be a memorial to you. So the day of the Lord's passing over the people of Israel when he struck the Egyptians would become a memorial day for Israel. And that would be called Passover. Later on in this chapter, he's gonna talk about that as well. He's going to single out this day, this very day, the same day. In chapter 13, he says, remember this day. This is a memorial. Never forget. Remember this day. Deuteronomy 16:3. You're going to eat unleavened bread, the bread of affliction, so that you may remember all the days of your life, the day when you came out of the land of Egypt. Never forget this day. Never let your children forget this day, or your grandchildren, or your great-grandchildren. Remember this day. This is a memorial, and you're going to remember it throughout your generations, and you're going to celebrate it as a feast of the Lord, as a permanent ordinance. So this particular feast is going to be one of the three required feasts. So in Exodus 23 and 34, Deuteronomy 16, he talks about three times a year, I want you to celebrate this. I want you to celebrate the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Feast of Weeks, the Feast of Booths. Three times a year, first month, third month, seventh month. You need to come up to Jerusalem. Eventually, he's going to tell them where. You need to be there, and you need to celebrate three times a year these feasts. It's a permanent ordinance. You don't get to miss it. Now, later on, he's going to give them instructions. Well, what if I'm unclean on the 14th day of the month? I obviously can't celebrate the Passover. So he says, okay, well, if you're unclean, then you can celebrate it on the 14th day of the second month. In other words, you may be unclean the first month, you had better not be unclean the second month. You better take precautions. And I don't care if you're on a journey, you don't get to not celebrate it. This is a permanent ordinance. You have to do this. So verse 15, 7 days. So 15 to 20 deal with the details involved in the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So the Passover was the 14th day of the first month. The Feast of Unleavened Bread begins the next day and goes to the 21st. So 7 days, you're going to eat unleavened bread. And on the first day, you're going to remove leaven from your houses. And it's not just going to be from their houses. Chapter 13, he says, you're going to remove the leaven from your borders. And in Deuteronomy 16, he says, there shouldn't be any leaven in all your territory. So you don't just remove it from your homes. You remove it from all your territory. There shouldn't be leaven within your borders. So whatever leaven you have, you destroy it. And then on the 22nd day after the Feast of Unleavened Bread, you take your little glob of wet dough and you set it in the windowsill and let the natural leaven work its way into it, and you create your sourdough starter all over again. And then the next Passover, you kill that and you start over again from scratch. So no leaven in your houses, in your border, in your territories. Interesting that Paul uses that concept in 1 Corinthians 5. Clean out the old leaven. Get rid of all that old stuff so you can start over again. He says, whoever eats anything unleavened from the first day until the seventh day, that person shall be cut off from Israel. Now, to be cut off from Israel, it meant several things. You could be excluded from the camp. So you're an outcast from the camp. You could be separated from covenant rights and covenant privileges. Genesis 17, 14 indicates that. You could also be put to death. And in Exodus 31, 14 brings that point out. However it's taken here, I mean, he's not specific, but that whoever eats unleavened, that person is cut off. And verse 19, it's not just the native Hebrew. It's anyone living within the borders of Israel, even an alien. No one was to eat unleavened bread during these 7 days. So on the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, you shall have a holy assembly. And these instructions are repeated in Leviticus 23 and Numbers 28. So you have, on the first day, you have a holy assembly. On the seventh day, you have a holy assembly. No work is to be done. The other passages in Leviticus 23 and Numbers 28 say no laborious labor is to be done, except what must be eaten by every person, that alone may be prepared. So the only work you can do on the first day and the seventh day is prepare your meal. That's it. That alone can be done. You shall also observe the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Now, most Bibles, the words feast of are in italics. It's because they're not there in Hebrew. This, it's simply called, you shall observe the unleavened bread. And the word unleavened bread is the Hebrew word matzah. So he's saying, you shall observe the matzah. And this is the first reference to the naming of this feast that's associated with the Passover. It's not called the Feast of Unleavened Bread before this. He's talking about eating unleavened bread, but this is the first time that it's identified as an event. And he says, on this very day, I brought out your hosts out of the land of Israel. So observe this day throughout your generations as a permanent ordinance. And he keeps on repeating that idea of a permanent ordinance multiple times in this chapter. One of the things that you're going to notice when you get into the New Testament, I think, in Luke 22, the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread were so closely connected that oftentimes their names were interchangeable. So in Luke, he talks about observing the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which is called Passover, when in fact they were two separate events, Passover first, then the Feast of Unleavened Bread. But they were really closely connected. So he repeats himself, on the first month, on the 14th day of the month at evening, you shall eat unleavened bread until the 21st day of the month at evening. The Lord repeats himself multiple times in this chapter because he wants the people of Israel to get this. This is probably the most important day for them. This is the birth of the nation. The nation is coming out today. This is their first month. This is the Passover. This is the Feast of Unleavened Bread. All of this is happening in a matter of hours. So he wants them to get it. 7 days, there shall be no leaven in your houses. Whoever eats what is leavened, that person shall be cut off from the congregation of Israel. And it doesn't matter if he's a native Hebrew or if he's an alien. No one eats leaven during these 7 days. You shall not eat anything leavened. It's like he's rewording this so that there's absolutely no doubt in your mind what he's talking about. Eat nothing leavened. Don't eat anything leavened. In all your dwellings, you shall eat unleavened bread. And then he gives them some more instructions regarding the Passover. That's how important this is. So essentially, there's more than half this chapter is dealing with the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. They haven't even gotten out of Egypt yet. So Moses called the elders. And so verses 1 to 20 are the instructions that God gave to Moses. Now Moses is giving these instructions that he received to the elders of Israel. And he says, go take to yourselves lambs according to your families and slay the Passover lamb. This is when they're going to do it. Take a bunch of hyssop. Hyssop is just a bushy plant. It kind of grows everywhere. Solomon in 1 Kings 4 talked about it growing on the walls. It I don't know, it's probably maybe 18 inches. Narrow stems, pinkish, purplish flowers. It's kind of like a really pretty weed. And he says, take a bunch of hyssop and dip it in the blood and smear the blood on the doorposts and on the lintel. So Moses is telling the elders, this is what you need to relate to the people. And once you put the blood on the doorpost, you don't go outside the house until morning. It doesn't matter what you hear. You don't go outside the house. So they're going to hear Egyptian neighbors weeping and wailing over the death of their children. He says, stay in the house. You don't go out until I tell you to. Kind of like with Rahab and the spies. Once you hang that cord on your window, you don't go outside the house. So the Lord is going to pass through, smite the Egyptians, and when he sees the blood on the lintel and on the doorposts, he's going to pass over, and he's not going to allow the destroyer to come into your houses to smite you. So Moses got it from the Lord. He's giving it to the people, and he's assuring them, you stay in the house that you put the blood on the doorpost and on the lintel, and the Lord's going to pass over you. Don't go outside the house. You shall observe this event as an ordinance for you and your children forever. So again, there's that ordinance. This is a permanent ordinance. You do this throughout your generations forever. When you enter the land, which the Lord will give you, as he promised, you shall observe this rite. So the instructions in verses 1 to 20 are actually for the time they enter the land, and even for the time that they're wandering in the wilderness. This is how you do it. It's a rite that they had to observe. And when your children say to you, what does this rite mean to you? So as time goes on, as they leave Egypt and as they're wandering around, they're going to be in the wilderness for 40 years. And they're going to be going through all of these rituals, and new kids are going to be born. And the kids are going to say, why are you doing this? What's the purpose of this? When they get into the land, and as decades go by and centuries go by, people are going to ask, why are we doing this? What is the purpose of this? And Moses says, this is what you tell your kids. It's a Passover sacrifice to the Lord. He passed over the houses of the sons of Israel in Egypt when he smote the Egyptians, but he spared our homes. And what's interesting is, like when you read through Deuteronomy, there's a number of passages. Let me just give you an example. In Deuteronomy 6, he says, these words which I'm commanding you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your sons, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, when you rise up, and when your son asks in time to come, what do the testimonies and the statutes and the judgments which the Lord our God commanded you, what do they mean? This is what you should say. We were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt, and the Lord brought us out by a mighty hand. So they go back to this event. This is what it means. We were slaves, and the Lord brought us out by a mighty hand. Joshua talks about it. The Psalms talk about it. Throughout the Old Testament, this event is the most important event. And then it says the people bowed low in worship. So when the people of Israel heard what the Lord was about to do for them and the memorial that he established to commemorate the event, they bowed low and worshiped him. Then the sons of Israel went and did so, just as the Lord had commanded Moses, so they did. So they selected a lamb for each family. They killed it. They collected its blood in the basin. They took a bunch of hyssop, applied it to the doorway. Then they ate the lamb and did all of that, and their feet are girded. Their staff is in their hand. They're ready to go. And then the call goes out. Came about at midnight that the Lord struck all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, exactly as he said he would do. He told them back in chapter 11, about midnight, I'm going to go through the land. And he told him, he told this to Pharaoh. I'm going to go into the midst of Egypt, and all the firstborn of the land of Egypt is going to die, including your firstborn, Pharaoh, and the firstborn of the slave and the firstborn of the cattle. Nothing's going to be spared. So at midnight, the Lord did exactly what he said he would do and when he said he would do it. He didn't, I got some time here. I might as well just do it now. He gave them until midnight to repent. They didn't repent. He did what he said he was going to do. Struck down the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on his throne, the firstborn of the captive who was in the dungeon, all the firstborn of the cattle. Pharaoh arose in the night. Now, he and his servants and all the Egyptians, and it doesn't say whether Pharaoh and his servants and the rest of the Egyptians were watching over their children that night. I suppose if somebody had told me that my firstborn son was going to die at midnight, I'd kind of hover over his bed. You know, maybe that's what happened. And as soon as Pharaoh's noticed that his son wasn't breathing anymore, and his servants and the Egyptians noted that their firstborn was dead, there arose a great cry in Egypt. There was no home where there was not someone dead. So there's this outcry going on in Egypt. So Pharaoh calls for Moses and Aaron, middle of the night. Rise up, get out from among my people. You, your son, the sons of Israel, go and worship the Lord that, like you said, take your flocks, take your herds, take your women and children, get out. And bless me too. So up to this time, the Lord's been demanding that Pharaoh let his people go. And Pharaoh keeps on saying, oh yeah, you can go. But he loads on all of these conditions. Now, Pharaoh's the one who is demanding that Moses and the people of Israel leave. And there's no conditions. You take everything. Just get out from among my people and bless me. I think Pharaoh finally came to realize the power of the one true God over him, over his people, over his gods. I think he finally came to realize that this devastation on his country, this carnage among his people, this is a God before whom I probably should humble myself and seek his blessing. But his humility is rather short-lived when he realizes in chapter 14 what he's done. He has a change of heart and goes after Israel, which was his last and final fatal mistake. So the Egyptians urge the people to send them out in haste. We're all going to be dead. So it wasn't just Pharaoh demanding Moses and the people of Israel leave. The rest of the Egyptians did. They pleaded with the people of Israel to leave. Get out without delay. If you stay, we're afraid that the deaths that occurred with the firstborn, they're going to spread to the rest of us. And we're all going to be dead. So please leave. So the people took their dough before it was leavened and their kneading bowls bound up in the clothes on their shoulder. They kind of took what they could carry. And if they had carts, you know, they tossed everything into the cart and just headed out. They got their, you know, hobo stick with their clothes on the end, on their shoulders, and their kneading bowls and their unleavened dough in it, and they're on their way out. So the sons of Israel had done according to the word of Moses, And so back in chapter 3, God told Moses that, okay, when you leave, that the people are going to ask for articles of silver and gold and clothing. In chapter 11, he tells the people of Israel, this is what you need to do. Go to your neighbors and ask them for articles of silver and gold, clothing, whatever you can get. And the Lord, they did that. The Lord gave them favor in the sight of the Egyptians, and they gave them whatever they wanted. You go to your neighbor's house. Yeah, can I have a talent of gold? Oh, sure. Here, take two. Oh, you want some silver? I got some silver. You need some extra changes of clothes? I mean, the Lord just gave them favor and they gave everything away. And so he says at the end of verse 36, they plundered the Egyptians. So the Lord granted them favor in their sight and they got out with all those goodies. When you get later on in Exodus, you'll see why they needed all of that gold and silver. The construction of the tabernacle took a lot of gold and silver. And so most of this gold and silver is going to go toward the construction of the tabernacle. And you can read that in the later chapters in Exodus. So the sons of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot, aside from women and children. Now, there's actually 603,550 men over 20. That doesn't include the women. That doesn't include the children. That doesn't include guys younger than 20. So my guess is there's probably close to 2 million people leaving Egypt. That is basically twice the population of Montana, just walking away. Now, when they talk about these locations, Ramses and Succoth, and later on in chapter 14, he talks about Pi Hahiroth and Baal Zephon and Migdal. Many of those locations, we don't know where they're at. So if you see them located on a map, that's really just speculation. A lot of maps, they'll put a question mark by it because we just don't know. We really don't know the route that they took for the Exodus or for the wilderness wanderings. Many maps for the Exodus and for the wilderness wanderings give multiple possible routes. Most maps usually show a northern route, a central route, and a southern route. I prefer the southern route. That's my personal preference. When it comes to the location of Mount Sinai, again, we're simply speculating. There are maps that show as many as 16 possible locations for Mount Sinai, and they're all over the place. I prefer the traditional location in the southern region of the Sinai Peninsula. Other people prefer other regions in Midian. It's a matter of preference. We just don't know. So from this point on, until the end, almost the end of chapter 13, all of this is taking place in Succoth. So what he's going to tell them now is taking place in Succoth. So a mixed multitude went up, and the mixed multitude would be the people of Israel as well as some Egyptians. Egyptians that came to fear the God of the Hebrews because of the plagues, possibly other peoples who were enslaved in Egypt. They're seeing this, hey, the Hebrews are leaving. This is my perfect opportunity to leave as well. So they escaped their own bondage, and they're going up with Israel out of Egypt. mixed multitude. That mixed multitude is going to cause some problems later on. The flocks and the herds, very large number of livestock. They baked the dough. So when they got to Sukkoth, they baked the dough that they brought out of Egypt into unleavened cakes. It hadn't become leavened because they were driven out of Egypt and couldn't delay. And they hadn't prepared any provisions for themselves. They just grabbed what they could and headed out. The time the sons of Israel lived in Egypt was 430 years. So we can actually date that back to the Lord's final confirmation to Jacob of the Abrahamic covenant and Jacob's arrival in Egypt in Genesis 46. That took place in the year 1876 BC. So the departure would have taken place in the year 1446 BC. Now, there are some who give some other dates that just frankly don't make sense, but most conservative scholars say the Exodus took place around 1446 BC. So they were in Egypt for 430 years to the very day that Jacob came in, to the very day all the hosts of the Lord went out from Egypt. So the exact same day that Jacob came in, his descendants came out. And when he talks about the hosts of the Lord, it's the Hebrew word for armies. The armies of the Lord went out from Egypt. And he says, it is a night to be observed for the Lord. So you observe this night, the night of the Exodus. It's to be remembered, observed, celebrated throughout your generations. The Lord brought you out of the land of Egypt. Don't ever forget this event. we're running out of time, so I'm going to stop there at verse 43, and we'll pick up at verse 43 and do chapter 13 next week. So, any questions?
I have a question.
Okay.
Carmen has a question at the chapel here.
Okay. So when Moses writes about being cut off,
uh-huh,
what exactly would that mean for an individual? And was it temporary?
Well, he doesn't specify what he means in this particular context, but in other passages, to be cut off from Israel meant that you were cut off from the covenant promises or the covenant privileges. You were severed from that, and that may very well mean what it means here. If you eat leavened bread on this day, I'm severing you from all of the covenant promises I made with the people. Other contexts indicate that to be cut off is actually to be put to death. He could mean that here. He just doesn't tell us exactly what he means by that. It could be either one of those.
Thanks.
I have a question, Jeff. It's Neil at the chapel. So my question is, does the word Passover in verse 13, verse 23, and verse 29, does it mean skip? When we say Passover, does that mean to skip, or does it mean
protect. Because when I read 13, it appears to be skip. But then in 23, it says the Lord will pass over the door and not allow the destroyer, not a capital D in destroyer. So
well, yeah,
you get what I'm saying?
Yeah, as far as capitalization is concerned, Hebrew didn't have capital letters.
Okay.
So whenever we capitalize something in English, we're just guessing.
Okay. All right.
I personally believe that destroyer should be capitalized.
Okay. That's good to know.
As far as Passover, let me look.
So is it the sense that, is it the Lord being like the ark to Noah in protecting him from the storm and the judgment where this is happening? Or is the sense that the Lord is skipping that house so that the people in it aren't killed? That's always
when he's talking about the Lord will pass over the house, it's the sense of he's going to skip the house.
Okay.
When he uses the word Passover in verse
23, halfway through, the Lord will pass over the door.
Yeah, that's that would simply mean he's going to skip the door.
Well, but it says the Lord will pass over the door and not allow the destroyer. That's almost, to me, sounds like standing in the door so no one can get in. That's, maybe I'm wrong. I'm just, that's what, how I read the Lord.
Yeah, will pass I over guess the I door have it. I get the impression that the Lord is going through and the destroyer's following.
Yes.
And so the Lord skips the house and the destroyer skips that house as well.
Oh, okay. I never thought of it that way. All right. I'm appeased by that.
Okay. You're propitiated.
Jeff, is the Lord the destroyer?
I've always looked at the destroyer as the angel of the Lord.
Yeah.
In the same way, the angel of the Lord was the destroyer when David sinned. You know, he had his sword out of his sheath.
Jeff, couldn't it be though? This is Ray. There are some pretty powerful angels. I was thinking about when David in 2 Samuel, I think it's 24. He's given those three awful options for having taken the census. And at one point, there's an angel standing over Jerusalem to destroy that city. Couldn't it be, or like some of the angels in Revelation, do you think it's a divine figure, or is it an angel accompanying the Lord to do the... I'm just always curious about the path. It's sort of like what Neil was asking. I'm just always curious as to, is it a destroying angel, or... what makes you think it is divine?
I think the passage in 2 Samuel 24. Let's see.
And there are others too.
Yeah, I think it's the... Yeah, in 2 Samuel 24, verse 16, it says, the angel of the Lord was by the threshing floor of Araunah the Jebusite. So that is the angel of the Lord throughout the Old Testament is the pre-incarnate Christ.
Well, look at 17. Then David spoke to the Lord, 2 Samuel 24, verse 17. Then David spoke to the Lord when he saw the angel who was striking down the people and said, behold, it is I who have sinned. I don't want to belabor this, but I was just curious.
Well, I look at David speaking to the Father in heaven about the Son striking down the people.
It's very possible. Sure. Just curious.
So, yeah, I mean, that's how I've always viewed this passage where the destroyer was the same destroyer here as in with David. It's the second person of the Trinity going out to destroy, and the Father says, not that house, those are mine.
Yeah, pretty scary stuff.
Yeah.